Chapter 20. The Year of Dwarvenkind Reborn. Dale Reckoning, 1488. Flotsam.
Get up, he heard from far, far away. Wake up, ye shark food, get up!
Cold water splashed his face and ran up his nostrils, and he was vaguely aware of his own choking, that he simply wasn't getting enough air. His sensibilities returned a bit more, and he felt himself swaying, rolling with the undulations of the cold water about him. He crashed into something hard, shoulder and head, but it was a dull thump, again as if it had happened far, far away. He became aware of the sensation of falling, slowly, so slowly. Something, someone, grabbed him roughly by the hair and yanked him back up, and again he felt the water splashing about his face and up his nose and in his mouth, and again he heard the pleading and understood now that it was a woman's voice. Then he was rising, and what he felt more keenly was the water running off him, the change of pressure on him as he came out of the liquid, and the rolling waves splashing at him lower and lower on his body. He sensed that he was up in the air. Was he dead? That thought brought Wulfgar back to his senses, and he opened his eyes to find himself floating above the ocean, just above the side of a small dinghy, where a woman, Bonnie Charlie, grabbed at his legs to pull him into the boat. As soon as he was over the craft, he fell, and fell hard, crashing down into the small boat. It should have hurt more than it did, he somehow understood, but his body was numb, his feelings still distant. He rolled over, barely aware of his groaning, and there saw another person in the boat, Kimuriel.
You couldn't have let the fool down a bit easier then? Bonnie Charlie scolded.
I could have let you hang over the side, holding him by the hair until he drowned, Kimuriel answered.
And Wulfgar thought the words and the dispassionate tone so perfectly typical. Wulfgar tried to sit up, but his arms would barely answer his call, and the moment he moved, a burning agony across his back had him once more on the deck, face down, writhing.
Ah, but he's going to bleed out and be dead, Bunny Charlie cried. Be quick and get me that tar.
Wulfgar was lying in a way that left him staring at Kimuriel, and the psionicist gave a little snort and made no move at all. He heard Bonnie Charlie's harrumph as she moved over him, collecting the patch bucket they kept in all the small boats.
We've got to heat it, she said, looking all around. Look in the pail, Kimuriel told her. And when she did, she paused, then glanced up at the strange drow. It is not so difficult a task, Kimuriel added.
Bonnie Charlie dipped her hand into the goo and brought forth a blob, which she smeared across Wulfgar's back.
You'll have quite the scar, Wulfgar of Icewind Dale, she said. But at least you won't bleed out in me dinghy, what?
We'll need him to row as soon as he's awake, Wulfgar heard Kimuriel say. But he didn't see the drow then, for his eyes were clenched tightly as he fought against the pain of the warm tar covering his deep, open wound, pulling at the edges of his torn skin.
Row? He'll be lucky if he can stand, Bonnie Charlie replied.
Can stand, Wulfgar said through gritted teeth, and he pulled himself up to his elbows.
He felt as if a sword were still stuck into his back, stabbing and burning with every twist. He knew he was poisoned, for he could feel the sickly stuff coursing through him, but still with great determination he got one foot under him and pressed upward, coming shakily to his feet in the middle of the small boat. He noted then the parade of sails gliding away from him, heading east for Luskin.
First, Wavell, knock him over the side, Bonnie Charlie said, shaking her head. He's not rowing.
What happened? Wulfgar asked,
only vaguely aware of the events that had put him into the sea.
You missed, Kimuriel dryly answered.
Sank their ship, though, said Bonnie Charlie. Margaster ship, I'm thinking, and a fine one, so fine.
Now, she shrugged and nodded her chin off to the side, and out there in the darkness, Wulfgar could make out the low-riding hull of an overturned ship.
They took the heirloom, though, so might have been better if you hadn't sunk their boat.
Where's Calico Grim?
Bunny Charlie shook her head.
He is not our concern, Kimuriel interjected. We are for Luskin with all haste. Sit and take up the oars, Wulfgar.
He canna, said Bonnie Charlie.
Wolfgar fell as much as bent down to the bench seat, and he winced against the pull and pain as his arms went out to either side to grip the oars. He paused then, feeling something very uncomfortable, as if Camoriel was trying to get into his mind and possess him. Purely on instinct, he fought back with all his willpower.
Let me in, fool, Camoriel's thoughts said to him. You'll not row in such pain.
Wolfgar didn't know what to make of that, though despite his stubbornness and pride, he couldn't disagree with the drow's remark. In that moment of doubt, Camoriel slipped into his mind, and before Wolfgar could expel him, the big man found sudden relief, all of the pain simply dissolving.
What?
He asked aloud. The pain is in your mind, Camoriel said.
In my back, he corrected.
Your wound is still there, the drow answered. Do you feel it? That gave Wolfgar pause. The abyssal poison is still there, and yes, it will kill you if we cannot find you some help. Do you still feel it? He didn't. Like the burning pain that had been in his back, like the numbness in his arms, the poison seemed to him to be no more. Somehow, Camoriel had blocked it all.
Row, Camoriel scolded him.
Wolfgar took up the oars and gave a great pull, the small boat leaping away across the dark water. Bonnie Charlie crawled over and sat down before him.
Sorry about your hammer, she said.
We saw you caught in the rigging of the broken mast, but your weapon fell away to the ocean floor. Wolfgar returned her concern with a comforting smile, and more comforting than that, the barbarian lifted one of his large hands and whispered the name of his warrior god. Bonnie Charlie fell back and nearly over when Aegis Fang appeared in the man's hand.
Well now, there's a trick, she gasped.
It speaks to the skill of the maker, Camoriel said. Wolfgar looked to the drow curiously, for that was as close to a compliment as he had ever heard from Camoriel, and one to a dwarf, no less, to Brunner, who had crafted the weapon for Wolfgar those years and years before. Now, if you would be so wise as to put the weapon down and take up the oar instead, perhaps we will survive this night, Camoriel added. And do take care when you put it down so that you do not drive it through the hull. Wolfgar offered a sour look at the ever-insulting drow, then took up the oars with fervor, growling with every powerful stroke. The small boat raced past the wreckage of many ships, past many men and women in the water clinging to flotsam and jetsam. If you stop for one, we'll be overrun, Camoriel told Wolfgar and Bonnie Charlie. The water is not that cold, and they will survive the night. Their only chance is for us to get to Luskan and send out ships. The drow was correct, Wolfgar knew, but rowing past stranded sailors, though he knew not which side most of these folks had been fighting for, pained him deeply. He grew less concerned soon after, though, when, at a gasp from Bonnie Charlie, who sat facing him and therefore looking forward past him, he slowed and glanced over his shoulder. An orange glow brightened the eastern horizon, and it wasn't the dawn.
It would seem that our enemies are wasting no time, Camoriel said from the front of the boat.
Wolfgar bore down and pulled harder, each great row lifting the prow from the water. The tide had turned and was heading back in, so again they had following seas. Still, they had a long way yet to go, and after a while, even mighty Wolfgar needed to rest. He lifted the oars and swung about on the bench to view the city, close enough now that he could make out the general outlines of some of the taller structures. A good portion of Luskan was in flames, and the armada of enemy ships sat near in the harbor, catapults and wizards letting fly flaming pitch and magical fireballs.
Well, what do we do now? Wolfgar asked.
Is the city even fighting back? Wondered Bonnie Charlie.
Some are, some aren't, no doubt, Wolfgar replied. It's Luskan, after all.
He looked straight at Camoriel as he added.
Though I'd venture that the supposed leaders of the city are risking themselves in battle.
Camoriel didn't answer, not even an arch of a thin white eyebrow. Wolfgar hated him. A separate response came to Wolfgar's doubts a moment later, though, in the form of a huge explosion near the northern edge of the city's silhouette,
a vast fireball stealing the night, then rolling up like a living mushroom, spewing smoke and roiling flames. Bright flashes of lightning followed quickly, sharp and punctuating, as if the rising fireball itself were some strange and magical thunderstorm. When that ball rolled higher, illuminating the distant structure below it, the three on the boat knew exactly the source, however, with bolts of destruction flying from the branching arms of the host tower of the Arcane, thundering down to the field below to obliterate the invading forces.
"Your warhammer may kill a demon or a gnoll," Camoriel remarked. "How many do you think Gromph and his fellow wizards are melting right now before our eyes?"
Wulfgar didn't turn away from the spectacle to bother looking at the strange drow.
"Make for the mouth of the River Mirar," Camoriel said.
"The host tower?" asked Bonnie Charlie.
"No, the Dragon Reach and Close Guard Island."
"It's overrun, no doubt," the woman replied.
Camoriel shook his head, doubtful. "There is no easy way into Ship Kurth, not at this time."
"Easier than the host tower," Wulfgar argued.
"Our enemies now know that," Camoriel said. "But they would not have, and they would have continued across the bridge to the second island and the magnificent host tower, obviously the prized structure of the city."
"You assume much," said Wulfgar, "and if you are wrong..."
"There are ways into Ship Kurth," was all that Camoriel would offer as an explanation. "Do as I command." Bonnie Charlie started to argue with the psionicist, but Wulfgar quickly raised a hand to stop her. Camoriel didn't need them, he knew. The drow could magically walk away from this boat and could sink it as he left. Or, even worse, he could get into Bonnie Charlie's mind and convince her to dive overboard and swim as far under the water as she could and there take a deep breath. Wulfgar didn't know Camoriel very well, but well enough, he thought, to believe that the drow would have no qualms at all about doing exactly that, to Bonnie Charlie at least, though the barbarian figured that his own friendship with Drizzt, and so with Jarlaxle, might stay the psionicist's devilishness from him. His reasoning didn't convince him, though, not with this one. Wulfgar obediently put his oars into the water and pulled for a spot just to the right of the host tower, the channel called the Dragon Reach. Gromph Beyenri took a deep breath, blowing out the exertion of releasing what might have been his greatest fireball of all. He pondered that as he looked to the field about the host tower, littered with the smoking remains of the pirate horde. Demons, gnolls, humans, goblins, even ogres. An impressive force, though stupid and ill-guided. They had crossed right past Ship Kurth, the seat of power of Luskan, to attack the host tower. And now they were dead, or soon to be, every one. Gromph considered his fireball, enhanced by his growing proficiency in the magic of psionics. Camoriel and the Mind Flayers had given him access to deeper concentration, and that purer focus was leading to some very impressive spells indeed. Never had the great Gromph imagined that his arcane powers could improve any further. Still, he remained somewhat humbled. He had felt the power of the illithid hive mind flowing through him not so long ago, a force so magnificent that it had held in check the combined martial and magical power of all of Menzo Berenzon. Then he had helped direct that barrage into a single strike through the body of Drizdo Erden to obliterate the physical manifestation of Demogorgon, the Prince of Demons. Such power, true and pure. Gromph wanted to feel that again, and next time, he wanted to be the one creating it. A lightning bolt flashed down from just above him, from his favorite non-drow host tower associate, the cloud giantess Cecilia. That lovely behemoth had surprised Gromph repeatedly since the beginnings of this new order of mages, and now again. She had claimed that her magic was all divination, illusion, and harmless conjuring. But when Gromph glanced down at the newest hole on the field, where her lightning bolt had struck, a deep scar and one lined by a trio of corpses of minor demons who had almost made it to the base of the gigantic tree-like structure, he was positive she was much more powerful than she had let on. More lightning rained down from above, many of the host tower's wizards vying to kill the last remaining enemies on the field. Gromph glanced to the southeast across the city, to see the fires and the continuing battles. He moved to a crystal ball set on a pedestal, the magic of the scrying device carried to every chamber in the host tower, allowing Gromph to communicate with any of his associates or with all at once as he did now.
"Enough," he told them. "Many more will soon come against us, I expect. Conserve your power, Cecilia. I would speak with you."
He ended the magic without waiting for a response. He answered the knock on his door without question, expecting the cloud giantess. Instead, he found a Netherese man wearing a look of great concern. "I did not summon you," he told Lord Paris, another of the host tower's associates.
"Summon?"
the former leader of the Shade Enclave in the Netherese Empire asked in confusion.
"No, I must speak with you."
"You have finished your studies regarding the gate?"
Gromph asked him, hoping it to be the case. He and his wizards had one more duty to perform under their agreement with Jarlaxle and King Brunner, to complete the magical portals tying Gauntlegrim with the three dwarven strongholds of the Silver Marches.
"I was interrupted," Lord Paris replied.
But as he began to elaborate, he was interrupted again as Cecilia came bounding down the stairs in the central trunk and turned into the entry hallway to Gromph's personal wing. Gromph smiled as he regarded her. She used spells to keep herself small enough to easily navigate the corridors of the host tower. But though the Dwyomers shortened her, they did so in a distorted manner, reducing her height much more than her girth, so that she looked like a blue-skinned halfling viewed through a curved window that made all of her features thicker. Still, the effect wasn't all that unpleasant, Gromph thought, and besides, of all the wizards at the host tower, Cecilia was the finest, other than Gromph himself, of course. She also knew her place and remained back when she noticed Gromph conversing with the Netherese lord.
"You were saying," Gromph prompted.
"I told you that I had found some runes on the portal's top piece, tiny but definite," Lord Paris explained. "I was down there trying to make some sense of them yet again. They're not an old dwarvish, I now know. But before I could properly decipher them, I found a visitor."
"A visitor?"
"At the portal."
"From Gauntlegrim,"
the Archmage reasoned, since that was the only open magical connection to the portal beneath the host tower. But Paris shook his head.
"Not one who came through the portal, no."
Gromph arched an eyebrow at that. No one was supposed to be anywhere near that host tower portal without Gromph's express permission, which he had not given to anyone. He considered the possibilities, then said,
"Catty Bree."
Again, Paris shook his head.
"You should come with me, Archmage. She was quite insistent that she speak with you and you alone."
"She?"
"From your homeland, I am sure."
Gromph sighed at that. He thought at first that it must be his daughter, Evenel. But Paris knew Evenel, so why would he be so obviously unnerved? Had one of Gromph Banri's sisters come to speak with him, and why there at the portal? He pushed past Paris, heading for the spiral stair. "Follow," he instructed both the Netherese lord and the cloud giantess, and down he led, more angry than intrigued. That anger turned to something different, though, when he passed through the last doors to the small side room holding the magical teleportation device.
"You should move more quickly," Matron Jindia Malarn greeted him.
It took all of Gromp's willpower to stay in assault, with words or perhaps even a spell. What was this creature doing here at this time? And she was not alone, flanked by a trio of other drow women. One he thought her first priestess, who had previously been a matron of her own house, Kennefin. The other two were Hunsrens, including first priestess Chari. This was no minor entourage.
"You might have noticed that I and my associates were a bit busy."
"Indeed," answered Jindia.
"And I will forgive you for so incinerating my forces. The demons will gate in new ones in short order."
"Your forces?"
"Of course."
"You play dangerous games. This is Bregendierf's city with the blessings of Matron Mother Bayenri."
Matron Jindia sighed and snapped her fingers, and two more drow women suddenly appeared beside her, noticeably naked and quite beautiful. Too beautiful. And that, along with their absence of clothing, allowed Gromph to recognize them for what they were. Escavidni and Yekadaria, the handmaidens of Lolth.
You see, Archmage, I would argue that Bregendy Earth is the one playing dangerous games, along with your sister, the Matron Mother. Jarlaxle and his rogues, pray tell me that you have not joined with that wretched troop, have the blessing of Matron Mother Bayenry, but I, you see, have a greater imprimatur still. What do you want? Gromph asked sharply, using anger to cover his nervousness here, and he was indeed uneasy. He loathed Matron Jindia above all others, mostly because she was always so ill-tempered. But now, with the formidable power standing before him, he saw she was here with the blessing of the Spider Queen, and his distaste was being quickly replaced by a touch of fear. I am not holding you responsible for the misdeeds of your sister or of Jarlaxle, Matron Jindia said. Fear was in turn replaced with loathing. But Gromph held his tongue, though he could hardly believe this fool was speaking so of the Matron Mother of Menzo Berenzon. Even for Jindia, such a remark was remarkable. She went on, and I will not allow my minions to cross the second bridge again to assault your, whatever this ugly thing might be, because you have seen what will happen to them. Matron Jindia laughed at him. Because this is not your fight, she corrected. You are not even of Menzo Berenzon anymore. Consider that your good fortune. So I allow you to remain out of it, wholly so. Let Lolth decide who shall reign, the current Matron Mother, or the one who delivered to her Driz Doerden and Zaknafane. Gromph chortled loudly. All of this over those two insects. Madness. But not your madness, Jindia very sharply replied, poking a finger Gromp's way, as long as you prove that it is not. What does that? Shut down the teleportation portals, Matron Jindia demanded. Close this one, and do not let the dwarves connect to their other fortresses. Gromph balked. You can do it from here, from this host tower, which is tied to the primordial that powers the magical gates, Jindia insisted. He can, said Yikar Daria, before Gromph could deny it. That is my offer, this one time only, Jindia told him. Shut down the portals, go into your tower, and let this play out. When I am victorious, and I shall be, there will be no repercussions against you and your... She glanced past him to the grayish-skinned human and the cloud giant. Wizardly order. Gromph narrowed his eyes and stared hard. Decide, Archmage, Matron Jindia insisted. Gromph glanced back at his fellow wizards. His thoughts spun as he tried to make sense of any of this. He realized, though, that he was not being asked to choose between Matron Mother Bayenry and Matron Jindia. Not yet, not with this particular task. If he did as she asked, then surely Jarlaxle would be unhappy with him, and King Brunner would be truly outraged. But even if their side won, what would Gromph care? They wouldn't war with him, particularly since he would still hold the key to the entrapment of the fire primordial. But if he didn't do as they asked, then Matron Jindia proved victorious. Gromph turned back to Matron Jindia, then looked to the handmaidens. Lolth will demand her word be kept, he asked. Both laughed, for it was quite an absurd question, given the ways of the Lady of Chaos. She will not be displeased with you, certainly, Matron Jindia answered for them. Gromph thought it over for another few moments, then nodded his agreement.